Listener, after diving deep into another true crime story, I've been loving a little wind-down ritual at the end of the night, and that's exactly why I'm obsessed with Mood. Mood is the online spot for federally legal, hemp-derived cannabis grown on small, pesticide-free family farms right here in the U.S. They ship gummies, flower, edibles, pre-rolls, and more discreetly, straight to your door. No lines, no hassle. They've got something for every vibe. Chill for sleep, focused for deep work, happy and euphoric when you just want to feel good, or even that extra spark for better sex. My go-to lately, their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies. Super smooth, mind-soothing calm that kicks in fast and leaves me waking up clear. No grogginess. Perfect after a long day. And right now, first-time buyers get 20% off your entire order when you use my code Obscura at checkout. Head to mood.com, find the gummy, flower, or edible that matches your perfect mood, and save 20% off with code Obscura. Everything's backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. Go to mood.com/obscura and try it today. Listener, for some, summer is their favorite season. With travel picking up, kids out of school, and adventures on the horizon, for others, juggling everything can feel overwhelming, and you end up just surviving the season instead of thriving. As someone who covers heavy true crime stories week after week, I know how important it is to protect your peace and build in time for yourself, even during the busy summer months. I make sure to carve out moments that help me reset so I can keep showing up fully for my work and life. Therapy can help you better understand your needs, feel more confident setting boundaries, and create a version of summer that actually feels good. BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, with over 30,000 therapists and more than 6 million people helped globally. They have an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 from over 1.7 million client reviews. Their therapists are fully licensed in the U.S. and work according to a strict code of conduct. BetterHelp does the matching work for you with a short questionnaire so you can focus on your goals. And if it is not the right fit, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off BetterHelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com. On the afternoon of December 13th, 1989, two young men were taking a shortcut through a wooded lot in Volusia County, Florida, when one of them noticed what looked like a piece of carpet lying in the underbrush. The carpet was old and dirty, a remnant somebody might have rolled up and dumped from a truck. The wooded lot ran alongside Interstate 95, the same stretch of highway that carried tourists down from Daytona Beach towards the Cape, and that, on most nights, hummed with the low sound of long-haul trucks. The lot itself was a green margin between exits, a place nobody walks through unless they have a reason. It was a normal December in Volusia County, low 70s in the early afternoon, the humid weight that sits over the central part of the state from May through October has finally backed off, leaving the air still humid by anywhere else's standards, but dry by Florida's. The light at that hour is long and flat, coming in at a low angle off the Atlantic, catching the saw palmettos and slash pines, and turning the whole roadside scrub a pale gold for a few hours. A breeze off the ocean, the trade wind along the Florida East Coast does not stop for the season, but it does slow down a little. The wooded lot itself was mixed scrub of the sort that grows in the disturbed soil along an interstate corridor in central Florida. Pine, palmetto, a few scrub oaks, Spanish moss hanging where the canopy thickened, the understory of vines and dead palm fronds that turns any walk off the shoulder into a careful one. The lot was bordered on one side by the interstate, on another by a service road, and on the other two by more of the same scrub. It had the anonymity of land nobody owns in any way they bother to enforce. People dumped things in there. Refrigerators, mattresses, the carpet remnant. The men got closer to the carpet. The carpet was covering something. Underneath was a body. He was male, middle-aged, fully nude. He had been dead for somewhere between 10 days and 2 weeks. The Florida heat in early December is forgiving compared to the Florida heat in August, but it is not forgiving enough that a body left exposed in a wooded lot for that long is going to be in any presentable state. Decomposition had set in. The skin had begun to slip. The abdomen had bloated and then partially collapsed as the gases of putrefaction worked their way through the soft tissue. Blowflies had laid eggs in the open wounds and in the natural openings of the body, and the larvae had cycled through their feeding stages and moved on. The face, the hands, the soft tissue of the abdomen, all of it was already past the point where a casual observer was going to do anything that resembled a normal identification. Now uncovered, the smell was unreal, and by the time the first cruiser pulled onto the shoulder of the service road, the smell reached out 50 feet. One of the deputies was sick in the brush behind the cruiser. The other was not. Both would carry this particular memory of that afternoon for years. The skin on the body had begun to come away from the underlying tissue at the points of contact with the ground. The fluids of decomposition had darkened the soil in a ring around him. There was no good preparation for what waited under the carpet remnant. What the medical examiner could read through the decomposition was the cause of death. He had been shot multiple times. The rounds were small caliber. Two .22 caliber bullets had been found in his left lung. The medical examiner found one of them lodged in soft tissue when he opened the chest. The track of the bullets through the chest cavity told the story. Each round had punched through the chest wall, opened a channel through pulmonary tissue, and stopped somewhere inside him. Air had leaked out of the lung into the pleural space. Blood had flooded in alongside it. The collapse of the lung against the chest wall had been progressive, not instantaneous. He had not died on impact, listener. He had drowned in his own chest cavity over the course of minutes, while his other lung had tried and failed to compensate. Those two rounds in the left lung were the ones that had done it. His name, when investigators eventually worked out who he was, would turn out to be Richard Charles Mallory. His abandoned Cadillac had been found, dumped near Ormond Beach on December 1st, with his wallet still inside, along with some condoms and an empty vodka bottle. Until December 13th, he had been a missing person with a strange set of items in an abandoned car. After December 13th, he was the first body in what would become one of the most closely watched serial murder cases in Florida history. Nobody knew that yet. Not the Volusia County deputies, not the medical examiner, not the two young men who backed out of the brush and called the police. As the day progressed, the light slowed. The pines warmed. The wind off the Atlantic moved through the palmettos. Somewhere along Interstate 95, a long-haul truck shifted down a curve. The body of what had been a man, what would eventually be returned to a name, lay in the disturbed soil under the carpet that covered it for 2 weeks. And Eileen Carol Warnos was just getting started.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Centuries. And I wasn't doing anything out there wrong or mean to anybody. What they did was mean to me. I was very kind, very nice, had a very ladylike attitude. I didn't do anything wrong to them. I didn't even hardly swear. I talked about religion and politics and even talked about trying to save the Lord with some of them. I mean, I talked about Jesus coming soon. And I was very kind. There was no reason to attack me.
You said what they did was mean to you?
What they did to me was violent and mean.
Who are you talking about?
We're here on Richard Mallory, and I'm talking about Richard Mallory right now.
You said they.
I'm not going any further into this.
Chapter 1. Richard Mallory. Richard Mallory's last day on this earth was a Thursday. He owned an electronic repair shop in Clearwater, on the west coast of Florida. He was 51 years old. He had a history. In 1958, in Maryland, he had been charged with assault with intent to rape. He had spent the years between 1958 and 1962 committed to a maximum security correctional facility for treatment as a sex offender. The facility's records, which would be uncovered years after his death, included a 1961 evaluation noting that Mr. Mallory possessed strong sociopathic trends. None of this was on his record in Florida by 1989. None of it had been entered into any database that a Florida deputy could pull up. He was on paper an electronics shop owner with a clean local profile. Mallory had a long pattern of disappearances from his shop. He would leave for days at a stretch, drink heavily, visit sex workers, and eventually surface and go back to running the business. By the standards of his behavior in the years before his death, the morning of November 30th, 1989 was nothing unusual. He closed his shop in the late morning and started drinking. He drove. He had a 1977 Cadillac. That Cadillac put him on Interstate 75, and Interstate 75 brought him into the geographic territory where his killer was working. She was 33 years old. She had a .22 caliber pistol in her bag. She had a partner waiting for her in her motel room. She had whatever amount of alcohol she had in her bloodstream that night, which was, by Tyra Moore's later account, a considerable amount. They met. He picked her up. They drove her to a remote area for what was supposed to be a paid sexual encounter. The exact mechanics of what happened in the woods that night are knowable only to the two of them, and Mallory has been dead for the better part of 40 years. The version that became the public record is the one Eileen herself eventually gave during her trial in 1992, and during her various interviews on death row, which is to say, an evolving and inconsistent version. In the early version, she said Mallory had beaten her, raped her, and sodomized her. She said he had used rubbing alcohol on his own genitals and on her body. She said she had fired in self-defense. In later versions, she said the killing was something closer to retribution, that she had started shooting at men who reminded her of every other man who had hurt her. By the very end, on death row, she would tell some interviewers she had been a rage killer, and that the self-defense narrative had been tragic. Not to jump too far ahead, but I think this is important to touch on, listener, is that by then, Eileen Wuornos's mental health had been suffering.
They had the intercom on in the room, and they kept lying that it wasn't on, and they were using sonic pressure on my head since 1997. Every time I was trying to write something, I think they had some kind of eye in the cell, I'm not sure, but every time I started writing something, it went up higher. So I'm thinking that probably had the TV rigged. The TV or the mirror, something was rigged. They got a huge satellite on the compound. After they put the huge satellite on the compound, it could have been either rigged to the TV set or the mirror or something, because the electrician, when he put the mirror on the wall, he said, doesn't that look like a computer? The back of it, and they stuck it to the wall. It was crushing my head, and they were using sonic pressure.
I want to point out some things. Eileen Wuornos's version of the story, at least with Mallory, seems consistent. Richard Mallory had a history of attempted rape. In my experience, men that commit these type of crimes and are given such a slap on the wrist tend to repeat themselves. It's very uncommon for them to fully recover. I'm not telling you what to believe, listener, but I will say that there is a great argument for self-defense, at least in this first killing. Now, let's get to the physical evidence. What the physical evidence said was this. Richard Mallory was shot multiple times with a .22 caliber pistol. The autopsy initially noted 3 rounds. Later analysis suggests that he had been shot more times than that. 2 of the bullets perforated his left lung. He was shot at relatively close range while seated, in a position consistent with being inside or near his vehicle. The rounds entered the front of his torso and angled downward and inward, an angle a shooter produces when seated next to or slightly above the victim, and firing across at an upward angle. A .22 is a small round. It does not have the stopping power of a larger caliber. What it does to the chest is slip through the ribs and soft tissue and continues traveling inside the body, sometimes ricocheting off bone and resetting itself in tissue several inches from the original wound track. 2 of Mallory's rounds opened his left lung. The lung began to collapse almost immediately. Air vented into the pleural space. Blood pulled into the same cavity through the torn pulmonary vessels. His good lung, the right one, would have tried to compensate, but the pressure shift in his chest would have begun fighting it. Richard Mallory was awake for some portion of this. The chest cavity does not stop a brain from working. He would have understood that he was bleeding internally. He would have felt the sudden inability to draw a full breath, the burning compression of a chest cavity filling with the wrong fluid, the rising panic of a body trying to inhale through a lung that was no longer doing its job. His pulse raced. His vision narrowed. The peripheral world began to gray out at the edges. By the time enough blood had accumulated in his chest to stop his heart, he had been dying for a measurable stretch of time. The medical examiner, working backward from the wound tracks, estimated the lethal sequence at somewhere between 2 and 7 minutes. The shooter then dragged or moved the body into the wooded lot beside Interstate 95, took the carpet remnant from the back of the Cadillac, and laid it over the body, then drove the Cadillac as far as Ormond Beach, parked it, and walked away. Eileen got back to the motel sometime after the killing. She told Tyra Moore that she had killed a man that day. The Cadillac was found on December 1st. The body was not found until December 13th. The Volusia County investigation began the next day. Detectives had a name, an empty vodka bottle, a missing wallet, and a body in the woods. They did not have a suspect, a witness, or a clear motive that did not also fit 100 other plausible scenarios involving a middle-aged man who had picked up a sex worker on the wrong night. For 6 months after Richard Mallory's body came out of the woods, the case sat on a desk in Volusia County, going nowhere in particular. Then, the second body turned up. Chapter 2. David Spears. David Andrew Spears was 47 years old, a heavy machinery construction worker out of Winter Garden, Florida. He drove a pickup truck, a man who left for jobs at sunrise and came home covered in dirt. He had been declared missing as of May 19, 1990. On June 1, 1990, his body was found alongside U.S. Highway 19 in Citrus County, Florida. Citrus County in early June is a different country from Volusia County in December. The Florida summers come on hard by late May and stays hard through October. The temperature in Central Florida in the first week of June runs in the low 90s during the day, and the humidity sets in the 70s and 80s, which means the actual experience of walking outside is something like the experience of walking into a hot, wet wall, listener. The clouds build through the afternoon and break on most days into either a hard rain or even a thunderstorm that anyone who has lived in Central Florida any length of time knows about on an intimate level. The land off US 19 on the Gulf Coast side of the peninsula is flatter than the East Coast scrub. Slash pine plantation, cabbage palm hammock, scrub jay habitat, country where a body left in a wooded clearing in early June is, within a day, going to begin to undergo decomposition at a rate the temperate north does not produce. He was nude, lying in a wooded area off the highway, the same general geography where Richard Mallory had been left 6 months earlier. He had been shot 6 times with a .22 caliber pistol, the rounds spread across his torso. His pickup truck was eventually located in Marion County, with the license plates removed and a number of his personal items missing. Tools he had been carrying in the truck were also gone. So was a portion of his cash. 6 rounds in the torso is a different conversation than 2. 2 is what stops a man. 6 is what a shooter fires when they want to be sure, or when they have already lost the cold calculation that turns a killing into a clean job. The rounds in David Spears' torso were spread across his chest and abdomen. The autopsy track suggested some of them had been delivered after he was already on the ground, fired downward into a body that was no longer presenting as a frontal target. The Florida heat had been working on him for the better part of 2 weeks by the time his body was found. The skin had blackened along the lines where it had been in contact with the ground. The eyes were gone. The lower abdomen had been ruptured. The smell, by every account from the deputies who responded to the scene, was a smell you'd remember for the rest of your life. Animals had visited the body. The medical examiner had to work around what was left to figure out what had killed him, and he was eventually able to recover 4 of the 6 rounds from the body cavity, with the other 2 having either passed through or been worked out by decomposition. The missing tools mattered. because the tools that came out of David Spears' truck ended up, weeks later, on a pawn shop counter in Daytona Beach. Eileen needed cash. She had taken what she could carry. She had pawned the tools under one of her aliases. The pawn ticket, with a thumbprint and a signature, was sitting in a Florida pawn shop intake binder waiting to be matched. None of the investigators knew it was waiting there. David Spears was a quiet, decent working-class man. He had a family. He had co-workers who had been expecting him at a job site. The weeks that follow a missing persons case in a working-class American family, when the missing person is the breadwinner, are weeks of grief that does not show up on the news. Bills do not stop arriving in the mailbox when a body rots in the woods. The lights have to stay on. The mortgage payment is due on the 1st. Somebody has to call the boss and explain that he is not coming in. By the time David Spears was identified, his family had been doing that work for almost 2 weeks. The Citrus County deputies working the case did not yet know about the Mallory case in Volusia County. The two crime scenes, separated by 6 months and a few hundred miles of Central Florida Road, were sitting in two different file cabinets in two different sheriff's departments, with no investigators yet looking at them side by side. The .22 caliber bullets in David Spears' body would eventually, in a ballistic comparison, match the ones in Richard Mallory's. The match was still weeks away. Meanwhile, a third body had already been left. Chapter 3, Charles Karskadin. On May 31, 1990, the day before David Spears' body was discovered, Charles Edmund Karskadin was killed somewhere along the Central Florida road system. He was 40 years old, a part-time rodeo worker out of Missouri, traveling at the time of his death, a man whose absence might not be noticed for days. His body was found on June 6, 1990, in Pascal County, Florida. He had been shot 9 times with a small caliber weapon. The body had been wrapped in an electric blanket and was, by the time it was found, in advanced decomposition. The wrapping stuck out to investigators. It suggested somebody who had taken time with the body, somebody who had made a decision after the killing about how to leave the scene. The 9 rounds in Charles Karskadin were distributed across his torso, his arms, and his head. The medical examiner, opening the electric blanket in a Pascal County morgue, found a body that had been emptying itself into the wool of that blanket for days. The fluid of decomposition had soaked through the fibers and pulled at the bottom of the wrapping. The flesh underneath the blanket had partially liquefied in the summer heat. When the medical examiner peeled back the corner of the blanket, the underlying tissue did not hold its shape against the open air. Skin came away with the wool. The face, what had been a face, had become something the human eye does not have a clean reference for. And the technician assisting with the unwrapping did not look at it directly for the rest of the morning. Some of the rounds had passed through the body. Listener, financial stability is something I wish more people had, especially after the stories we cover. Chime is changing the way people bank with the most rewarding, fee-free banking built for you. They're not like traditional banks with overdraft and monthly fees. Get access to thousands of fee-free ATMs and keep more of your own money. Direct deposit lets Chime members benefit from up to $1,150 in annual rewards, fee-free. Chime has 5-star customer service from real humans, 24/7. Upgrade to America's number one choice for banking. You can get 5% cash back on your Chime card for gas or groceries. Savings that grow with 3.75% APY, 9 times the national average. Premium travel perks, early pay with MyPay, and Spot Me for fee-free overdrafts up to $200. My younger self would have benefited from this. Chime is the most rewarding way to bank. Join millions today at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Sign up in just a few minutes.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
Listener, if there's one refresh worth making this season, it's your bedding. Summer nights always leave me wanting bedding that feels lighter, more breathable, and genuinely comfortable. That's why Quince is my go-to. They focus on high-quality materials like European linen and bamboo, but without the luxury markup. It's a perfect balance, where everything feels elevated, but still effortless. Quince has everything you need to upgrade your bed for summer. Lightweight sheets, airy linen shams, and duvet covers in seasonal colors, and timeless patterns like stripes and soft neutrals. Their 100% European linen bedding is woven from high-quality flex and somehow just gets softer every time you wash it. If you're more of a cotton person, their organic cotton sheets are incredibly soft and breathable. Plus, they also make mulberry silk pillowcases. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. I use Quince bedding, and you should too. It has truly changed the way I sleep, and it's not just bedding. Quince has really become a destination for elevated essentials across fashion, home, beauty, and beyond, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into your everyday life. Elevate your summer bedding. Go to quince.com/obscura for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/obscura for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/obscura. April had not. The 22 again entered, tumbled, fragmented, and stayed. One of the rounds had clipped a major vessel and dumped a substantial volume of blood into his abdominal cavity. Another had entered through his upper arm and worked its way into the chest, along an unpredictable path. A third had taken him in the head, after he was likely already on the ground, and lodged behind the orbital bone. Charles Karskinen did not get a fast death. He went into shock from blood loss while he was still conscious. By the time the ninth round went into him, he had been dying in stages for an extended stretch of time, while his shooter stood over him and kept firing. A witness had seen Eileen Warnos in possession of Karskinen's car. Eileen had also pawned a gun identified as belonging to him. Neither fact was yet connected to the file. They would be eventually. They were not yet. Three bodies, May into June, three different counties, three different sheriff's departments. None of the investigators were yet looking at the killings as a series. The fourth man on the list was the one whose body would never be found. Chapter 4. Peter Symes. In June of 1990, a 65-year-old retired merchant seaman named Peter Abraham Symes left his home in Jupiter, Florida, and started driving towards Arkansas to visit family. Peter Symes, of all the men whose paths crossed Eileen Warnos's life that summer, was considered the gentlest. He had retired from the Merchant Marine and spent the bulk of his retirement working with a Christian outreach ministry, distributing Bibles, doing low-key religious volunteer work. On his way north out of Florida, somewhere along the way, he picked up two women. His body would never be recovered. His car, a 1988 Pontiac Sunbird, was found on July 4, 1990, in Orange Springs, Florida. The car had not just been abandoned, it had been wrecked, run off a road, and into a wooded area. Two women had been seen abandoning the vehicle at the scene. One was described as a heavyset blonde, the other as taller and thinner. They had argued, pulled bags out of the vehicle, and walked off into the woods. By the time deputies arrived, the women were gone. What the deputies recovered from the Sunburn turned out to be the most important piece of physical evidence in the entire case to that point. A palm print on the interior door handle, other prints on the trunk. The print did not match anybody yet in the file, but they were preserved, photographed, and entered into the National Crime Database. The accident in July of 1990 was the moment the Florida investigation finally got its first real handhold. Up until then, the cases had been three bodies, three counties, three separate detectives, and no central thread. The Symes car crash gave investigators two suspects with prints and two photo composite sketches based on eyewitness accounts of two women seen walking away from a wrecked car that belonged to a missing minister. Peter Symes, in the meantime, was somewhere. Florida is full of places a body can be made to disappear. Cypress sloughs, whose tan and dark water swallows things without remark. Sandy back roads that run for miles between citrus groves. Coastal mangroves whose roots hold a person under in a few feet of water. Whatever happened to him on whatever afternoon in June of 1990 did not happen in front of any witnesses who came forward. His family would not get a body. His family would not get a grave. His family would get a 1988 Pontiac Sunbird and a missing person whose file that has been open ever since. The composite sketches went to the Florida media that fall. By the time they did, two more men were already dead. Chapter 5. Troy Barres. Troy Eugene Barres was 50 years old, a sausage salesman from Ocala, Florida, working for a meat company driving deliveries up and down the Central Florida route. He had a wife, kids, the normal middle life most of us recognize. He was reported missing on July 31st, 1990. On August 4th, his body was found in a wooded area along State Road 19 in Marion County. He had been shot twice. The body was in advanced decomposition because of the Florida summer. An empty cash bag from a bank near his delivery route was found near the scene. Whoever had killed him had taken the day's receipts. By the time deputies got to him, 4 days of Central Florida August had done their work. The temperature in that part of the state in late July and early August runs in the mid-90s to the early 100s and barely drops out of the 70s at night. A body left exposed in those conditions undergoes accelerated decomposition. The bloating phase had peaked and given away. The flesh had darkened and split along pressure lines. Insect activity was severe. Both rounds had been delivered to his torso. The medical examiner, working with what was left, was able to confirm the caliber, the entry angles, and the rough sequence of the shooting. Barres had bled out into the leaf litter of a Marion County woods over the same slow window the others had. The two rounds had not killed him quickly. They had killed him by progressive blood loss while he was conscious enough to know it. State Road 19, where the body was found, runs north through Marion County into the rural Florida interior. The land along that road is the land of cattle ranches, citrus groves that have been replanted three times after as many killing freezes, slash pine, palmetto scrub, and the occasional cypress dome rising out of a wet depression. It's the part of Florida that many visitors don't usually see. In August, the cicadas in that country are loud enough at midday to drown out the sound of a passing truck. The afternoon storms come up out of the Gulf and roll east across the peninsula on a schedule you could set by watch. Country where a man's body, dragged a few yards off the shoulder into the leaf litter under a stand of pines, is going to stay invisible to the passing traffic for as long as the wind does not shift the wrong way and the scavenger stays out of sight. His wife's name was Letha Barres. She would, in the years to come, become one of the most public faces of the family members of Eileen Wuornos's victims. She attended hearings, she attended the eventual execution, she spoke on the record about what it was like to have a husband who would simply not come home from a sales route one afternoon. Letha is a figure who carries the long, quiet weight of this case. By the end of August 1990, four men had been killed along Central Florida highways inside 3 months, all middle-aged white men, all traveling alone in vehicles, all shot at close range with a small-caliber weapon, all found nude or partially nude in the wooded areas off state roads or interstates. The pattern was now visible to investigators comparing notes between counties, and the bulletins were going out across multiple jurisdictions. They had a serial offender on their hands. What they did not yet know was that the offender was not a man. Chapter 6. Charles Humphreys. Charles Richard Humphreys was 56, a retired major in the United States Air Force. After his military career, he had worked in two roles. He had been a state child abuse investigator in Florida. He had served in a different period of his life as chief of police, a man whose entire adult professional life had been spent investigating people who hurt people, particularly people who hurt children. He was killed on September 11, 1990. His body was found on September 12th in Marion County. He was fully clothed. He had been shot 6 times in the head and torso. His pockets had been turned inside out. Whoever had killed him had stripped his pockets for cash and identification and not bothered to undress him. 6 rounds, head and torso. The autopsy detail on Charles Humphreys is the detail that closes the self-defense argument the moment a juror reads it. The shots to the head were grouped. They were not a single panicked round followed by chaotic other shots, they were placed. Two of the rounds in the head had clustered on the same side of the skull, on a tight pattern that suggested the shooter had not been moving while firing. Powder stippling on the skin around those entry wounds confirmed the close range. The shooter had been standing within an arm's length of him at the moment of those rounds. A third round had taken him from the back of the head, lodged in the soft tissue at the base of the brain. The rounds in the torso were also a tight pattern. Whoever shot Charles Humphreys had taken the time to aim. The brainstem damage from the headshots would have ended consciousness almost immediately, which is, in the dark math of this case, a small mercy Charles Humphreys received that several other victims did not. He did not get the long bleed out in a wooded clearing. He got something faster. The rounds in his torso were surplus. The shooter had kept firing after the threat had stopped existing. His car was found a week later in Suwanee County. The license plates had been removed. Items from inside the car had been taken. The Humphreys killing complicated the moral architecture of the case more than any of the others. Eileen would later claim, in the videotaped confession she gave, that all seven of the men had begun some form of sexual aggression towards her, and that her killings were therefore self-defense.
And it never worked when I had weapons of other weapons. I never could defend myself. So I finally got a gun where it would be defense.
Well, how many times during the 4.5 years you lived with Ty Moore did you have to defend yourself?
I was raped 3 times. And there was 2 other instances where I had a gun, but I didn't use it. They just had their fun. They were young guys. I didn't need to hurt them because they didn't use any weapons on me or anything. And the other 3, I had 2 gas guns and a bullfighter. And I got raped and beat up royal on those.
So you say there are 5 times you had to defend yourself with weapons while you were being raped, but didn't have to use a gun?
Yeah, and the 2 guys that were, one looked like about 22 and the other 27, that's when I had the gun just before Mallory.
Asked about Charles Humphreys specifically, she would tell investigators that he had attempted to assault her. Richard Mallory's last night, given his Maryland record, makes the self-defense framing very plausible. But the geometry of this killing was not the geometry of a fight. It was of an execution. Chapter 7. Walter Antonio. Walter Antonio was the last man, 62 years old, a trucker, also, in another part of his life, a part-time security guard, and a police reservist for Brevard County, Florida. Like Humphreys before him, the seventh and final victim had given part of his life to law enforcement. The irony does not skirt by this podcaster that many of the victims who picked up Eileen Warnos were cops in some form or another. Perhaps the same law enforcement officers involved in sex worker stings across the country. Walter disappeared on November 18, 1990. His body was found on November 19th in a remote area near a logging road in Dixie County, Florida. He was nearly nude, wearing only socks. He had been shot 4 times in the back and head. His car was found 5 days later in Brevard County. The license plate had been removed. Dixie County sits up against the Gulf in the Big Bend, the long curving stretch of coastline where Florida Peninsula meets the Panhandle. It is some of the least populated country in the state. The land flat, the drainage is poor, most of it is timberland, working pine plantation, and slow brown rivers that carry tannin out of the swamps. The logging road where Walter Antonio's body was found ran through one of those timber tracks. In mid-November, the temperature in that part of the state runs in the low 70s during the day and drops into the 50s at night. The mosquitoes thin out a little. The afternoon storms taper off. The air takes on the dry, clear quality that the Florida winters wears for a few months before the spring humidity rolls back in. It is, by Florida standards, the gentlest part of the year. It is also the part of the year when a body left in a pine plantation on a logging road in country where the nearest house is miles away is going to lie undisturbed until somebody happens to drive past on the right kind of errand. 4 rounds, back and head. The geometry of those wounds, when investigators reconstructed them, told the story of a man who had been turning to run, or who had already turned, when the shooting started. The first round, by the autopsy track, had entered through the upper back and traveled through the right thoracic cavity, opening the right lung. The second had entered the lower back and lodged in the abdominal soft tissue, severing a kidney along the way. The third and fourth had been to the head, and they had been delivered after he was already on the ground or going down. Walter Antonio had not been facing his shooter when she opened fire on him. He had been trying to get away. The blood pattern, the body's position when found, and the angle of the rounds confirmed it. He had been killed running. Walter Antonio's killing came almost exactly 12 months after the killing of Richard Mallory. 12 months, 7 men. The arithmetic, when investigators eventually laid the dates out side by side, told the story almost on its own. This was not a series of opportunistic encounters. This was a person operating at a sustained pace, accelerating slightly toward the end, who had killed roughly one man every 2 months for a calendar year, with the gap between Mallory and Spears as the only meaningful pause. That pause, in the larger outlook of the case, looks like the time it took her to convince herself the first one had been justified, that she could do another, and that nobody was coming for her. By the time Walter Antonio was found, the investigation had finally started to come together. Chapter 8, The Composite. By the fall of 1990, several Florida law enforcement agencies were comparing notes. Volusia County had Mallory, Citrus County had Spears, Pasco County had Karskadin, Marion County had Barres and Humphreys, Dixie County had Antonio. The case file on Peter Symes, with no body but with two suspects and two palm prints, was sitting open in another department. The breakthrough that finally tied them together started in late summer, when ballistic analysts in different counties began running the 22 rounds recovered from each victim against each other. The match was conclusive. The same weapon, or the same kind of weapon, had been used in all of them. A single 22 caliber pistol, Central Florida wide, was leaving rounds in middle-aged men picked up off the side of the road. This kind of finding ends a case being 7 separate files in 7 separate counties, and it starts it being one investigation. A Florida Department of Law Enforcement officer named Bruce Munster had begun pulling the threads together. He would eventually be on the receiving end of Eileen's videotaped confession a few months later. In the meantime, his job was to get the various pieces of physical evidence in the various counties to start telling a coherent story. The composite sketches from the Symes car crash hit the wires that fall. Florida newspapers ran them. Television stations ran them. Tips came in from people who recognized one or both of the women in the sketches. And on a particular afternoon in the last weeks of 1990, or perhaps the first days of 1991, Eileen Warnow sat outside her motel along the Central Florida coast and watched the sun go down. She was alone. Tyra had decamped to Pennsylvania. She had been moving between cheap motels and roadside bars along the I-95 corridor for weeks. She was drinking. She was broke. She was running on the fumes she had been running on for 34 years, and the people around her, by then, were no longer in any position to do anything about it. The motel was a place she had stayed at 1,000 times in her adult life. Single story, painted some pastel that had baked to chalk under the Florida sun. A row of doors, a row of windows, a row of metal chairs out front where the residents could smoke. A parking lot whose asphalt held the heat of the day long after the day was over. A motel that took weekly rates and did not ask questions. She sat in one of those metal chairs. In late December, along that coastline, the sun sets low. By 5:30 in the afternoon, it has come down towards the inland edge of the peninsula. The light it throws back at the Atlantic at that hour is a long, flat gold that turns as the minute passes into orange, and then into a deeper orange, and then into the particular Florida violet that only happens when there are clouds in the western sky to catch the last of the wavelengths the sun is still able to send up. The water on the eastern horizon goes black before the sky does. The high cumulus catches the color and holds it. The whole production lasts maybe 20 minutes, and then it is done, and the dark moves in fast from the east. She had a cigarette. She had a drink in a plastic cup the motel office handed out for free. She had whatever weight she was carrying inside herself that afternoon. which by then was the weight of 7 dead men, plus the long accumulated weight of everything else she had been carrying since 1962. To the west, inland, building over the interior of the peninsula, there was a storm cloud. Late season clouds, dark at the base, white at the top, where the anvil flattened out against the upper atmosphere. The kind of cloud the locals along the coast learned to read, because the clouds at that distance, on that bearing, on that schedule, is the cloud that is going to be over your house in about 2 hours, bringing rain and wind and the particular feeling of pressure the human nervous system registers before the storm actually arrives. She was watching the sky. She did not know what was already in motion behind her. The composite sketches from the Symes car crash were already in the Florida newspapers. The thumbprints on the pawn shop slips had already been pulled. Somewhere in an office in Daytona Beach, a file on Richard Mallory was being walked across a room to a desk where a file on Peter Symes was waiting for it. Somewhere in a different county, a sergeant named Bruce Munster was looking at a corkboard with pins on a map of Central Florida, and the pins were beginning to take shape. The investigation was no longer 7 separate files in 7 separate counties. The investigation was one thing, and the thing it was had a name attached to it now, and that name was hers. The storm cloud to the west of her kept building. She finished her cigarette. She put it out on the arm of the metal chair. She watched the violet go gray. She watched the gray go to dark. She got up, eventually, and went back inside her room.